Back on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Something like 60 million Americans have some kind of disability, so disabilities are not that rare. Having a disability can simultaneously make a person stand out from the crowd and be invisible. Visible from the disability, invisible in nearly everything else. We learn this and more in a memoir called Look Both Ways by Brooke Ellison. Brooke was paralyzed from the neck down in a car versus pedestrian accident at age 11. She's now an associate professor of health policy and medical ethics at Stony Brook University on Long Island, New York. Her earlier memoir, Miracles Happen, was adapted to a movie, The Brooke Ellison Story, directed by Christopher Reeve. Brooke Ellison, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
More than 20 years since the first book, how different does life look to you now?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. So when I first wrote Miracles Happen, I was a wee lass. I was only 22 years old, having just graduated from college. And, you know, I think that my perspective on my own life and disability was very different, kind of almost in coming to its fruition. It wasn't until many years thereafter that I was able to look at my life vastly differently than I had up until that point. After my accident, kind of 10 years after my accident, I still hadn't really understood disability in terms of the strengths that it creates for people, right? I understood it in terms of its deficits. I almost understood my accident and the disability that it had precipitated as only fundamental weaknesses in my life, things that I should not feel good about, or should other things that I should feel almost ashamed of, kind of buying into a very sociocultural stereotype of disability. All these years later, I've come to understand disability very differently. So I wrote Look Both Ways almost exactly 20 years after the publication of Miracles Happen. And, you know, this book is less a chronology of events that has that have transpired in my life, and much more kind of deep introspective lessons that I've learned about some of the struggles that you endure by virtue of living with disability, and how they are based in a society that's not necessarily all that welcoming to people with disabilities, and the virtues or the epistemology that I have developed, and many people with disabilities develop as well, kind of the skill set of adaptation and resilience that you have to start to develop just navigating a world that's not really fun set up for you. So that's kind of the difference between these two books and reflections on my life at two different, very different points.
So your thoughts on disability have certainly evolved over those 20 years. Have societies evolved as much, do you think, or are we pretty much in the same place we were? I mean, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act, but as you get to in the book, there are still some issues with compliance there.
Right. Yeah. So I think that we have made progress, but not nearly as much progress as we could have and ought to have. I've seen society, particularly over the past several years, you know, as we have grappled with racial reckoning and, you know, ideas of greater social justice. And so I have seen society make some inroads in terms of how we can include people with disabilities, but certainly not nearly as much as it ought to have. So I think that we typically understand disability in the terms that I had understood disability almost as, you know, people with disabilities as being that population that we can either choose to associate with or not, right? Or choose to include in how we think about the world or not. And, like, I think that's a really unfortunate way of looking at things. As far as I'm concerned, disability is a fundamental part of the human experience, right? And you know, it's just a part of humanity, as you had mentioned. There are millions and millions of people around the world, actually a billion people around the world, who live with physical disability directly, and many more on top of that who have family members or friends who experience disability. So it's kind of the biggest minority in the world, 15% of the global population experiences disability. So it's not a rarity by any stretch. And I think to understand disability as kind of like a binary construct that you either belong to or you don't belong to misses the kind of the bigger picture of how we're all on a spectrum of ability, and you know, that changes over time, right? It's not a category that you either belong to or you don't throughout your entire lifespan, kind of enter it or exit it at different points in our lives. And we should create a world that is as welcoming to everybody as we possibly can, right? Without buying into some of the visions of disability that I think we typically have, that people with disabilities are non-productive or not valuable parts of the world, or that their lives are not worth the same value as other people's are. And kind of shift the conversation to the kinds of assets that they bring to the conversation and to the world. Brooke, so we certainly haven't gotten to that point yet. Mm-hmm. The ADA has taken us to a certain point, but certainly not far enough. As you mentioned, I think the entire structure behind the ADA has been one of compliance and like one of establishing mandates, which for the time I think was necessary. I think that was the appropriate structure at the time, but I think we ought to be beyond that now. Like, we shouldn't be looking at access and adaptation as just like the bare minimum that we ought to make in order to give somebody just a token gesture. I think we should be thinking about how everybody is made better by the inclusion of people with disabilities, and that if you don't, you're kind of missing out. So that is the point that I would love to see society get to, and to whatever extent I can help to elevate or advance that conversation, I feel really quite proud.
Brooke Ellison is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, paralyzed and quadriplegic since age 11, the author of a recent memoir called Look Both Ways. Let me take this personally. People are wondering about the raspiness of your voice, and you mentioned in the book the 14 breaths you get from the ventilator every minute, which makes readers suddenly aware of, one, how often we breathe, and two, how seldom we think about it. You have never gotten used to it, you tell us in the book.
No. So that's a really interesting point, right? So I am acutely aware of every single breath that I take. Most people just do it unconsciously or subconsciously. I'm extremely aware of every breath that comes into and out of my lungs because it's powered by a ventilator. I'm not actually breathing in through my mouth or my nose. And that could change at any time, right? So I'm attached to a ventilator through a circuit of tubes. And if that were to become disconnected in any way, then I'm unable to breathe. And it's just a matter of time before unless somebody is here to reconnect, I could die. So I'm very, very acutely aware of that. So actually for many weeks after my accident, I was not able to talk at all. In fact, many people who are on ventilators are not able to talk, and certainly not with the fluidity or kind of the ease of speaking that I've been able to integrate into my life. And I feel very thankful about that. For sure, for 8 weeks after my accident, I was not able to talk at all. So when you are on a ventilator, typically what happens is the air comes through the tube and then goes back out the tube that it came in. And so the air doesn't ever go past your vocal cords. It doesn't allow them to vibrate. I've since had a little valve that allows me to do that. And I remember that was given to me, I think, 8 weeks after my accident. So for those full 2 months, I wasn't able to talk at all. I didn't think I was ever going to be able to talk again. And I remember when I first heard my voice after my accident, thinking, oh my gosh, this is not how I have ever sounded before. This is not my voice. This can't be my voice. And over the years, I've since gotten used to that. And, I it's the mechanism by which I'm able to communicate, right? It's the were it not for my voice, however different it might sound right now, I wouldn't be able to effectuate the change that I'm able to in the world. So I've come to love it, even though it's different, and you know, it's mine, and I know that it's quite powerful, even if it sounds weak or sounds different than everybody else's does.
You are a person of accomplishments. We haven't mentioned this yet, but you've gotten several degrees. You've got a PhD now. You're teaching colleges courses at Stony Brook. You've done all kinds of things in the world, and yet the reactions people have to you are based on your disability. You talked about, for example, somebody actually said to you once, "We don't want your kind here."
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So actually, so I did my undergraduate and my master's work both at Harvard. I did my undergraduate in cognitive neuroscience and then my master's degree at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government in public policy. So and then I did my I ran for public office. Actually, after that, I ran for New York State Senate and started a nonprofit organization. And then New Christopher Reeve had made a movie about my life based on my life from the time of my accident until my graduation from Harvard in 2000. And then, as you mentioned, now I am a PhD and I teach courses on medical ethics and healthcare policy and kind of disability as an applied avenue of medical ethics. And yet to this day, the only people who will see me and judge me entirely based on what they see without getting to know me. And I think that is an unfortunate strategy that many people implement into their lives. And I understand that. I understand kind of the hesitation or the, intrinsic discomfort that people feel about people with disabilities, largely because they have a lack of exposure. And despite the numbers of people with disabilities, people feel uncomfortable or they're going to embarrass themselves by trying to introduce themselves to somebody with a disability, I believe quite strongly that people don't know how somebody is either going to be able to respond or not. So they kind of expect the least level of ability so as to prevent themselves from being embarrassed, like extending a hand to somebody who might not be able to return the gesture or asking a question to somebody who might not be able to respond appropriately. So they assume those levels of inability rather than getting to know somebody. And yes, just as you mentioned, there have been instances where I've been in a public setting and people have either looked at me with some level of skepticism or have come right out and said to me, we don't want people like you here, right? So I was helping my brother find an apartment up in Massachusetts, so a state that is known for its kind of liberality and general acceptance of people. And we were at an apartment building, kind of looking around, and there was one of the inhabitants or one of the residents there. You came directly up to me and to my family and said, you can't live here. I don't know why you're here. We don't cater to your kind. And I said, that was the first time I ever had an experience so upfront and so jarring. I was just stunned to silence, and I think at that point in my life I really didn't have a capacity to even respond appropriately if I wanted to, but I was just stunned and devastated, and it kind of helped to steer my life in a direction that, wait a second, there is a lot that needs to be changed. There are a lot of stereotypes that people have that that need to be altered, and if I could play a role in doing that, even having undergone an experience like that, in order to get to that point, then I am eager to do it.
Brooke, in about 2 minutes, has technology evolved in 30 years to add to your quality of life?
Oh, technology is a tremendous part of my life. I know that I wouldn't be where I am today were it not for the technology that I use on a daily basis. I'm very much of a mind that you can't talk about disability without talking about technology and vice versa. I mean, so much so that I am right now, in addition to my position at Stony Brook University, the vice president of technology and innovation at an organization called United Spinal or United Spinal Association to talk to tech leaders about how to make their technology even more accessible for people with disabilities, specifically those with wheelchair users and those with spinal cord injury, because the horizon is so broad and the opportunity is so great and the impact on people's lives is so tremendous. We just think about it that way. And I understand disability to really involve the technology that we innovate that can either empower somebody or further disable somebody.
All right, we'll take a short break here. Brooke Ellison is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest memoir is called Look Both Ways. It's a look at where her life is now, approaching middle age and dealing with being a quadriplegic since age 11. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Brooke Ellison in about a minute and a half. This is the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're visiting with Brooke Ellison, who was paralyzed from the neck down in a car versus pedestrian accident. She was the pedestrian at age 11 on Long Island. She has since gone on to write books about her life. She has been in one of her books, her original memoir, was turned into a movie that Christopher Reeve directed, and her latest memoir is called Look Both Ways, and it's a chance to look at life from a different perspective from that first memoir from 20 years earlier. Brooke, I want to come back to technology for just a second, because there's a story you tell in the book about being able to use computers because of a tongue touch keypad, but then the company that made the tongue touch keypad couldn't make a profit and so ceased to make it. Have you run into several situations like that in your life?
Fortunately, not many, but largely because the technology that is most suited for me just doesn't exist, right? So yeah, the story that you're mentioning, I use it looks like almost like a retainer essentially, but a little bit thicker than that, that sits on the roof of my mouth that previously was able to activate my wheelchair, but then the kind of technology just didn't, it wasn't usable for new iterations of wheelchairs. So it also activated the mouse on my computer, the television, the telephone, right? So it offered all of these avenues of independence that I would not have had otherwise. And these are the things that people with disabilities kind of live without or learn to live without. But this technology afforded me the ability to do that, to access my world in a lot of ways, and to get through college, and to traverse the streets of Long Island running for public office. I was writing my PhD dissertation and kind of had plotted a plan a path forward and how I was going to get it done, and then had come home from the university where I was, Stony Brook University, in fact, and got a call from the owner of the company saying, essentially, sorry, we're not doing this anymore. We don't see this as within our financial best interest. And, good night and good luck. And I remember just sitting here in the same spot that I'm sitting in right now, actually, and thinking, I have no idea how I'm going to continue with my life. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know how I'm going to do my dissertation. I don't know how I'm going to drive my wheelchair. None of this. Like, I was just shocked. I felt like I had become paralyzed all over again. Fortunately, I have some friends at the university who are in engineering who can help me kind of limp along for all of these years. This is now, I think, 11 years or so, if not maybe a little bit longer, 12 years, allowing me to have technology that I can interface with my computer. But the level of innovation is just quite minimal, and it's been my experience that people with disabilities, especially those as profound as my own, kind of innovate on their own, right? Kind of do a lot of do-it-yourself projects, because there's just nothing in this space at all. And, you know, fortunately, there are some startup companies and even universities and students that have seen the level of challenge and said, okay, we can do something about this. We have the knowledge to do something about this. We have the technology. We just haven't directed it in the right way. And I think that's often what engineers are, is like problem solvers. They see a problem and they want to devise a solution to it. But many of them just don't fully understand or are not aware of the level of difficulty that many people with disabilities experience and how they can, you know, be a solution to it. So that's kind of how I've positioned myself, and many of the roles that I've taken on is kind of to be that bridge so people who have the knowledge and the skills to create this level of innovation can actually get it in the hands of those who need it the most.
Brooke, talk about your family, if you would. Your parents are your caregivers. You have a brother and a sister, and it sounds like you've been through quite a stew of feelings about responsibility and guilt and all kinds of things over 30 years since the accident.
Sure, yeah. So writing about my family and the role that I play about my family was probably the most difficult part of Look Both Ways. You know, I really forced myself to think very introspectively and very deeply about things that I never really wanted to think about before. I didn't really have the capacity, the emotional capacity to think about before. So, I kind of forced myself to think about, you know, not only the impact that my accident had on me, but on my entire family. And, you know, I knew that everybody was affected by my accident. Like, that was not news or kind of anything particularly insightful in my own self-analysis. But, I thought much harder about how the things that I was thinking about vis-a-vis other family members. So I kind of thought that since I was the person who experienced my accident most directly, you know, obviously since I was the one who was hit by the car, that, you know, essentially everybody had to just kind of accommodate that, you know, the kinds of changes that I had to undergo should be met with equal changes in everybody else's life. And, you know, that everybody else should just kind of fall in line because I had experienced the brunt of things. And like, that was just to be expected. Yeah, so I know now that was an unfair way of looking at things. Like, there were many hours of the day where my parents were dedicating their time to my care and taking care of medical needs. And I remember having this conversation with my brother not too long ago. He would be upstairs in his bedroom kind of looking at the globe or memorizing the presidents and that kind of thing, state capitals, kind of doing things independently. And my sister and brother had to forego a lot of the, I think, typical rites of passage that children experience because, I wasn't able to do those things myself. And, that was a loss for them. That was a big loss for them. I remember after my accident, my brother, my one mother was with me in the hospital for a total of 9 months. So she was away with me first at Stony Brook Hospital, so not too far from my home, but then all the way in New Jersey where I was in rehabilitation for 7.5 months. And, you know, my brother and I were and still are very close. So he lost for those 9 months, two key people in his life. And that was really traumatic for him. That was really a difficult experience for him to undergo, but he did it with, he did it bravely. He did it without ever questioning any kind of alteration in his schedule in his life that he had to, to integrate into it. And like, that was a big deal. So writing about those things and writing about how much I wish I understood those things as a child and had that level of self-awareness as a child that I think I have now. That is one of my biggest regrets, that I wasn't more mindful about those kinds of things and those kinds of sacrifices and pains that my sister and brother and parents had at the time of my accident and for years thereafter.
Brooke Ellison is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, paralyzed from the neck down in a car accident at age 11, writing about her life now in a second memoir called Look Both Ways. You write of the camouflage, as you refer to it, the disability camouflages the rest of you. I mean, so how much psychic work have you had to do in your life to show people who you are?
So I think this is typically the case, or is often the case, with people with disabilities. They get lost. They're obvious, but lost at the same time, right? They are very visible, but at the same time invisible in terms of their individuality or how they can contribute to the world, just the conversation, or to anybody's experience for the better. So I think it's often the case, and certainly has been the case for me, that people with disabilities feel like they have to be that much more than everybody else, right? You're that much funnier, that much more engaging, that much active in the classroom, in order for people to see them as anything other than somebody who just fits a specific stereotype. So that was something that I had to come to terms with in the years since my accident, that that I have something intrinsically worthy, right? I didn't need to feel like I needed to make myself something that I wasn't, or that people could see me as valuable just for who I am. Like, that took a little bit of time, and I didn't need to put that much pressure on myself, that I have gifts that I think people benefit from by knowing me. And that was tremendously liberating to get to know, and empowering to get to know, and took a lot of self-analysis and self-confidence and just kind of belief in myself, that, and belief in other people even, that maybe the thoughts that I had about how people were perceiving me was not giving them a fair shake either. So that was a lot of internal struggle and a lot of internal evolution that I think I'm not alone in. And I think, disability is a very profound and obvious manifestation of many of the struggles that people face, just generally speaking. Like, whenever we are experiencing challenge or difficulty of any kind, we feel like we're isolated, or we feel like people couldn't possibly understand our experiences, and thus we kind of distance ourselves from the enormity of the experience itself. And I think that doesn't do anybody any good, really. I think people can learn from each other, can benefit from knowing other people who have undergone hardships that are either similar to or slightly different from their own, and can grow together. So that was something that took me a bit of time to figure out, and to not feel like I had to be ashamed of my disability, or to hide it, or to try to mask it in some way, but be proud of it and know that people could learn something as a result.
Brooke, you tell us in the book that you get email from people all over the world, and you got one in particular from Connor Berryhill. Can you tell us what he wrote?
Yeah. So this email kind of came out of nowhere. I get correspondences from people who I don't know all the time, who have seen my film, who have read about me, who have heard about me in some way, shape, or form. And I got an email from a young boy, Connor, who has autism, is on the autism spectrum, and talked about how he was going to write a book about people with disabilities and how he views his disability and disability in general as a manifestation of superheroes, right? As superheroism. And I had never really thought about it in those terms before. And I thought about how brilliant and self-aware this child must be to understand his life in those terms at such a young age. It took me a very long time after my accident to understand my disability in terms of the virtues and the skill set that it creates for me, and the kinds of leadership and hopefulness and resilience that you have to integrate into your life when you live with a disability. This young boy had already thought about those things, had already viewed his life in those terms and from that vantage point. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. So he wanted me to be a part of the book that he was writing, and the story that he was telling, and even more so kind of the movement he was hoping to spearhead changing how we understand disability, you know, not just within the disability community itself, but in the entire, right, in the entire society. And like, that is so valuable. That is so important. And that, you know, certainly not to call myself a superhero in any way, but I think that disability really creates a unique vantage point from which to view the world. And like, that is really valuable, and it's different, and it's powerful, and it's meaningful and purposeful, and really important. So like, that was life-changing for me, and really an important way to, you know, to continue to move ahead with my life.
It's a pretty amazing book in the sense that you talk about some of the things you've talked about, just, you know, the stuff you've accomplished, you know, the PhD, the Harvard, all that stuff, and running for state senate unsuccessfully, as it turned out, in New York. But also you let us into your head, and there's some real honest stuff in here, and it's really a pleasure to get to read it. The book is called Look Both Ways by Brooke Ellison. Brooke, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
And that's it for today's exchange. Check us out online at jeffexchange.org. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. Nash Bennett is our assistant producer. Student assistants working the controls on live broadcast are Zach Beagle and Charlie Zimmerman. Our music is by Maxwell and Terry Longshore. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange. Stay safe and have a great day.